Hello, everyone. Welcome. It's good to see you all. My name is Daniel Roth. I'm a senior program manager on the ASP.NET team. And this is going to be a deep dive into ASP.NET Core 1.0. So hopefully you already know a little bit about .NET Core and ASP.NET Core. If not, don't worry about it. You all look like smart people. You'll still learn a lot. We're going to have a lot of fun. And if there's anything that you miss, you can always go back, read some of the docs, and I'm sure you'll catch up really, really quick. High level, here are the topics that I thought we would cover today. The basic idea is I want to start at the bottommost layer of ASP.NET Core, you know, its hosting layer, and we're going to work our way up the stack. We'll learn about hosting. How can you host behind IIS? We'll talk a little bit about the differences between hosting standalone applications versus portable applications in the .NET Core world. We'll look at the request handling pipeline, and we'll talk about middleware and how you build up your pipeline out of middleware. We'll then take a look at a specific middleware. We'll look at routing and how does the routing middleware really work. And we'll try and get an understanding of how MVC actually layers on top of the built-in routing middleware in ASP.NET Core. We'll then take a deeper look into MVC. We'll talk about some of the really cool and powerful extensibility features that we've added to MVC in ASP.NET Core. And then lastly, I hope to get to show you a quick preview of some of the new features that are coming in the next version of ASP.NET Core 1.1, which we hope to ship later this year. Now, if you haven't already done it, you should get started with ASP.NET Core and .NET Core. The way you do that is you're going to want to go to .NET. You're going to want to download and install the .NET Core SDK. You can do that on your Windows machine, Mac, Linux. If you're on Windows, you should get Visual Studio and install the .NET Core tools for Visual Studio 2015. Our docs are at docs.asp.net, and you can also, of course, find all of our sample code and our source code on GitHub at github.com/asp.net. And in fact, a bunch of the demos that I'm going to be showing you today are actually just samples that are already available up there, so you should definitely take a look at that. All right, so let's talk about hosting. Hosting is how you get your ASP.NET Core app up and running. Now, one of the interesting things about ASP.NET Core is that it is literally just a bunch of libraries. ASP.NET Core does not provide for you a hosting process. You get to provide the hosting process. And that gives you a whole bunch of flexibility. You can host your ASP.NET Core apps in a console app. You can host them in a Windows service. You can host them pretty much wherever you want. But you have to provide that hosting process, which means you need to build a host and get it started and get it listening for requests. And we're going to show you how you do that. So in general, for the most part, we look at our templates. ASP.NET Core apps are just like console apps. They have a program main. What does it mean to set up a host? Well, you're going to be doing these two steps. You're going to build a host, and then you're going to run it. You're going to get it started listening for requests. To build a host, you'll use a web host builder. And when you use a web host builder, you're going to configure a bunch of things like what server you want to use. You're going to specify your startup logic. And then when you build the host, it's going to set up all of the core hosting services, like the core iLogger factory, the iHosting environment. And then when you actually build it, the host will take your request handling pipeline that you've defined in your startup logic, and it will turn it into a request delegate. And a request delegate is really the core abstraction in ASP.NET Core. Everything that you do boils down to a request delegate, and it's really simple. It's just something that takes an HTTP request and does something asynchronously with it. Your whole app just becomes one single request delegate. And then after you've got your host built, you then start it up. You tell it to run. And when you do that, that will tell the server to start listening for requests. It'll get requests, and then it needs to hand it up to your app. And it does that by just invoking your request delegate. It's that simple. Now, when you configure your host, there's a whole bunch of interesting properties that you're going to have to deal with. You know, one is what server do you want to use? We provide a couple servers, actually, out of the box. The one we use generally is Kestrel. Kestrel is a cross-platform managed web server that sits on top of libuv. So you can run that on Windows, Mac, and Linux. It's blazingly fast. We also just recently shipped a release candidate of our WebListener server. WebListener is a very light layer over HTTP sys in Windows. And that's nice because it enables a couple of Windows-specific features like Windows Auth. It's in RC currently, so that one should be coming out stable shortly. So you can configure your server. You'll configure what address do you want your server to actually listen on, what host and what port. You'll specify your startup logic. You can specify what your content route is. This is an important concept. This is the location where your app stuff lives. Your app stuff includes things like your Razor views for MVC. It includes stuff like your static files, like your JavaScript files, your HTML files, CSS files. Those files generally need to be served up to requests, and that's generally done using the static file middleware in ASP.NET Core. Those files actually live in a special folder that's relative to the content root, which we call the web root. The web root is just a place where you want the static file middleware to look to expose static content to the internet. So you can configure your content root, you can configure your web root, which is generally relative to the content root. You can configure what environment you want your app to run in. Environment is a notion of like what is this place that your app is running in? Are you in development? Are you in staging? Are you in production? And the host then permeates that environment, it's just a string really, to the rest of your app so that in your app you can pivot based off of the environment that you're currently running in. Maybe you want to do something very specific while you're in development, but when you're production you don't want to be doing that. Like you have some diagnostic information that you use for development purposes and then you shut it off once you move out of the development environment. Lastly, there's the application name. This isn't really something that you configure, but it is something you should be aware of. It's the application name actually just maps generally to the name of the binary for your application. So if you go change that, you'll probably break your app, so probably want to leave that one alone. All right, so let's take a quick look at hosting. So this is Visual Studio. I created, basically just did file new project and created an empty ASP.NET Core application. And let's take a look at what it means to set up a host. Okay, so like I said, to create a host, you need to use a web host builder. That's what you're going to use. And then on your web host builder is where you configure all those different properties that we just mentioned. So first of all, you need to specify which server you want to use. Here I'm saying I want to use Kestrel. You could use WebListener if you wanted to. You could use your own server if you wanted to. If you feel like writing an HTTP server, that's totally cool. You could share it with the community. Maybe that could be a great thing. You can specify what server URLs you want to listen on. By default, ASP.NET Core apps will listen on localhost port 5000. Here I'm changing it to be port 5001 just to show that you can do this. And it's URLs with an S. Like for example, if you want to listen on both an HTTP and an HTTPS address, you would specify both of those here and configure your certificate and so forth. You can specify your content route. Now, content route is where your stuff is, you're saying where your stuff is located for your app, your views, your static files are relative to your content route. By default, the content route for your app is going to be the same as the, I think it's called the .NET application base path. It's basically the location where your app binary is living, is sitting. Now, during development, that can be a little inconvenient because when you build, the binary of your app is often a couple directories deep from your project. And usually you want to be dealing with your views in your project and your static files without having to copy them around. So we do a little trick with our templates, which is we specify the content root to just be the current directory because often you're working in the current directory when you're working with your project. So that's just a little trick that we do in the templates. Web root is the location where your static file content is living, JavaScript files, CSS files, and so forth. By default, that's going to be www root. And you can see that Visual Studio actually has some special knowledge of that folder. It knows that, oh yeah, www root is special. That's the thing that's actually exposed to the internet. This creates a nice separation between your app code and the stuff that is actually going to be available over the network. So app code, not available over the network, stuff in www root is. If you want to change this folder, you can. You can change it to foo or whatever, and that's totally fine. I'm going to leave it as the default. And then you specify your startup logic. Generally, when you create an ASP.NET Core app, you specify your startup logic using a class, a startup class. And a startup class has two things on it. We'll take a look at that real fast. It has a configure services method. That's where you're going to specify your application services that you want to be available through dependency injection throughout your app, and then configure. And this is where you define what do you want to happen when a request comes into your application. This particular app is doing something very simple. When a request comes in, it's just spitting out all of those host-specific properties. So it's getting the server addresses and printing out all the server addresses, and then it's going to print out the content root, the web root, the environment, and also the app name. Okay? So pretty simple. Okay, so that's basically all you need. I've done one more thing here, which is good to know about, which is if you would like your host to be configurable outside of this C# code, like you would like to be able to specify your server URLs using a file on disk or things like that, or be able to specify the environment with a file on disk, there's a nice extension method on the web host builder that allows you to configure your host using the configuration model. So up above, if you saw earlier, you can see I'm using the new configuration model in ASP.NET Core to say that I would like to read config values from this hosting.json file. It's just a JSON file on disk. This configuration model is just a really simple way to get name value pairs out of a variety of data sources. We give you providers for JSON files, XML files, any files, environment variables, and you, of course, can write your own. In this case, I'm just using this hosting.json file to configure my host. And that allows me to do things like say, well, actually, I want the environment to be staging, or I want my server URL actually to be on port 5002. Now, you'll notice that before I had specified a server URL earlier in code. So the calls to Web Host Builder are ordered. As you set these configuration properties on the host, you can think of them as like a property bag with keys, and as you continue to set them, they sort of stomp on the old value. So we would expect that this app now should be hosted on 5002, not 5001, like it was specified previously. And the environment should now be staging, okay? Hopefully we'll see that when we run the app. All right, and so I'm using the configuration model to be able to configure my host. You don't have to do this, but it can be nice if that's what you want to do. And then the second step, after we've built the host object, this is an iWebHost, is that we need to run it. And that'll start listening for requests. So that's how you set up a host. Let's run this app real quick and see what we get. So you'll notice that VS, by default, has set up the project to browse to port 5000. That's because VS is assuming that I'm using just the default port for the template. I've changed that, and then you can see now, like, well, there's nothing there. It's nothing at port 5000. Is there something at 5002? There is, okay? So that's how you can configure your host URL and port. And it says the addresses that my app is listening on, localhost 5002, that makes sense. There's my content root. It's the directory of my project. There's the web root. It's the content root plus www root. I'm in staging environment, like I can configure it in my hosting.json file. And then my app name is the name of the DLL, or the name of this project, hosting demo. Okay, so that's how you can configure your host. I'm going to shut this down. All right, now one interesting thing, this use Kestrel extension method, that's the sort of a, you know, a helper method to set up Kestrel. There actually is a use server extension method, and that takes an iServer. So this is where you could configure a server that, you know, maybe one that you wrote yourself or a third-party server if they didn't provide you a nice extension method like Kestrel does. So you could write an iServer. That sounds like great fun. We should try to do that. Let's try and write a server on stage, right? Let's see. I started one down here, and I'm not really gonna write a full server, but I'm gonna go through just real briefly how the server works in ASP.NET Core, because I think it's useful to understand what's really happening in terms of how requests are getting handled and how they get represented in the system. So here's iServer, and it's actually a really simple interface. The first thing that it has is it has a collection of server features. Now, what is a server feature? A feature is an interface that exposes some functionality about the server. So for example, remember in my startup code, you saw that I was going into the app, and I was actually querying the server features and asking for this specific iServer addresses feature. It's just an interface. And that allowed me to ask the server, you know, what are you listening on? That's an example of a server feature. Other servers might provide other features, and they just expose them as interfaces. And you can query for them. If they're there, great. If they're not, well, then you don't get that feature on that particular server. Does that make sense? Now, my little dummy server, I'm not going to expose any features because I'm just showing you the basic flow. You do need to implement the dispose pattern because servers generally allocate resources that you need to be able to free up. And then the meat of your server is going to be this start method. And what does this thing do? Well, this is where you would, you know, first of all, start listening for requests. You know, open socket. Start getting, you know, connections off of the wire. And then as requests come in, you need to process each request. I'm going to actually follow this code from the bottom up. So at the bottom, you see you get a request, and you're going to call process request async, and you're going to hand up a context object that represents the request. Now, how do you get that context object? What is that thing? You notice that that context object is a generic of tcontext, so how do you get one? There's a helper method on this application object for creating a context from a set of request features. And this is important. Requests in ASP.NET Core, how do you normally interact with the request and the response in ASP.NET Core? There's HTTP context, right? That's how you do everything related to HTTP in the ASP.NET world. Well, in ASP.NET Core, HTTP context is actually just a wrapper, a nice interface around a set of request features. Request features, just like server features, are just a bunch of interfaces that expose information about the request and about the response. So by default, it's required that servers need to expose at least two features about the request. They need to expose IHTTP request feature. If I take a look at that one, there should be nothing surprising. It's got a body, it's got the headers, it's got the method, it's got the URL of the request, right? And then the second one is IHTTP response feature. You have to provide these two guys. So you have the body of the response, you have the headers, you have the reason phrase, and the status code. So those seem pretty straightforward. You need to somehow take whatever you got off the wire or wherever you got this HTTP message and convert it into those two guys. But you could expose other request features as well. Like maybe your server supports things like WebSockets. You might expose a WebSocket related interface. Maybe your server exposes things about cookies on the request and response. There's actually a whole bunch of feature interfaces that we provide in ASP.NET Core that you can choose to support in your server. And those get exposed through the HTTP context. The core ones get exposed with a nice top-level programming model, but you can always just query for additional features. An example of this is the static file middleware. The static file middleware will look for an isendFile feature, I think is the name of the interface. isendFile is an API that's available in Windows that can allow you to download static files over the internet really, really fast. Like, I think it's like kernel mode something. It's really, 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 really ridiculously fast way to deal with static content from a server. And so the static file middleware will ask, do you support isendFile? If it's not there, if it is there, it'll use it. If it's not there, then it falls back to a still functional but less performant way of sending files. So that's an example of how these request features get used. And so that's how you can set up a server. Now, I had thought it would be epic to do an in-memory server up here on stage, find some way to create an HTTP message and send it into the server. But it turns out I don't have to, because we actually ship one in the box. There's another server in ASP.NET Core that is basically an in-memory implementation of this interface that you can use for test purposes. That server is called Test Server. Big surprise, Test Server. So to use that guy, you need to install a package. I'll show you which one. I've already installed it, but the package is actually called Test Host, because you're sort of testing your hosting, I guess. I don't know. So Microsoft ASP.NET Core Test Host is the package that has the test server. So you're going to want to install that. And it's super, super useful. So let's go back up to our app. And instead of doing this host and build here, we're going to take a look at this little piece of code. Let me uncomment it. OK, so I have a little from test server. So I'm creating a test server here. There's the server. And this is going to look a little flipped from what we just saw. Before, you created a web host builder. You told it what server you wanted to use, build, and run. With test server, what you do is you give it the web host builder. And it will take care of adding itself as the server. It will take care of also building the actual host from the web host builder. And then, what does run mean with this server? How does it work? Well, what it does is when you call create client, it'll give you an HTTP client. And you can make calls on it. And every time you make a call, that's calling into that start method. Remember down here? What was it? Start? It was start, right? Yeah. It calls into here, and you have a request now that you need to process. And so it will pump that HTTP request message, turn it into a bunch of request features, turn it into a context, and hand it up your whole application pipeline. So this means you can run your entire app, an MVC app with web APIs or whatever, all in memory, wherever you want, using this test server. That's really nice for integration style testing. Let me show you how that works. To do this, Let's see, so that all looks good. I'm actually gonna put a, just to prove that this is actually calling into code, I'm going to put a breakpoint here, and let's run this in the debugger. Now, it's popping up the browser, which is not gonna do anything, right? Because this test server is just totally in memory. It's not listening on the network. But you can see I'm already in my application logic. All I did was, right, was I called create client and it did get string async. I just issued a get request to localhost. The test server always just listens on a sort of a pretend localhost address and gets the string back. So let's see if that actually is gonna return. So F5, and of course I forgot a read line, so it's gonna just end. Let me do a control F5 so we can actually see the output. So this should display to the console the same content that we saw in the browser, right? It just asks for the set of parameters from the host and then gets it in the client and then renders it to the console. So that's test server. So you can do your entire app testing, integration testing in memory. That's pretty cool. All right, so I think that's all I wanted to show with hosting. All right, so let's move back here. So a word about hosting in production. So you've built your console app, your process that's hosting your ASP.NET Core application. Often you'll be using Kestrel. We do provide guidance that we don't recommend putting Kestrel directly internet facing. Kestrel is a new HP server. It's had a lot of great work done on it already, but we're not 100% confident yet that it can handle any and all malicious traffic that can come over the network. We're in the process still of hardening it, doing the last bit of security work on it so that it can be truly internet-facing and be safe to do that. So our guidance right now is that you should put something in front of the process that's using Kestrel that can handle the request, some sort of mature HTTP proxy. Now, on Windows, we would recommend using IIS, and we have actually a great story for integrating with IIS on Windows. If you're running on Linux, you might use something like Nginx or HAProxy, something that can terminate the request, just to make sure that nothing bad goes wrong with your Kestrel process because of a malicious request. So the high-level flow looks like this. You have the mean, nasty internet sending requests to you, and you have a mature proxy sitting in front. And that proxy, all it needs to do is forward requests to your Kestrel process, to your ASP.NET Core app. It also generally will do things like make sure that process is up and running and ready to receive the request, do some process management. IIS is particularly good at this. So let's talk a little bit about what it means to host your app in IIS and what that looks like. In order to help you handle that request handoff, we wrote a new native module that we call the ASP.NET Core module. And it plugs into IIS, and its job is to receive requests, and then you tell it a process that you want it to start up and hand that request off to. This is a pretty nice module. Supports a whole bunch of features. It can forward client certs. It can deal with Windows auth. It can deal with IIS sub applications. Even has an app offline feature where you can drop a, I think it's offline.htm or HTML file into your app, and that tells it, oh, I need to take this app offline so you can update it without having to deal with locked files. And it has some nice logging support as well. So it will forward requests to your app. And that's exactly what you want, right? You need a proxy that will receive requests and forward it to your app. To set it up, you're going to configure it in web.config. That's the only reason really why we have web.config files sitting in our templates, is to set up this module and to configure this module to start up your ASP.NET Core application. Now, to make it easy for you to have the right web.config, we actually have a simple little tool that we provide, that we call it the Publish IIS tool. And this tool does something incredibly simple and sets unbelievably high expectations. What this tool does is, it looks to see, do you already have a web.config file with the right IIS native module configured? If you don't, it'll create it for you. If you do, it'll make sure that it's configured correctly. And that's it. It doesn't actually move your app over into IIS or provision an app in IIS or anything like that. It just basically handles the configuration of this web.config file. You still have to go into IIS and set up the app and then point it at the directory. So when you do go to set up IIS, well, the way you should do that is you just point IIS at wherever your content root is. Remember we talked about the content root for your host. You'll point IIS at the content root. And then in your app, in order to enable it to receive requests from IIS, you should enable IIS integration in your host. The IIS integration piece is just a little bit of code that knows how to correctly receive requests from the ASP.NET Core module. And it will do some special tricks to make sure that it doesn't accidentally receive requests, stray requests from someplace else. The requests can only come from IIS. That line of code is completely benign if you're not using IIS. But if you are using IIS, it should be there. So that's why we add it to all the templates. If you're running on Linux and you see that line of code there and you start freaking out, like, I'm not using IIS, don't worry. It doesn't do anything if you're on Linux. It's only there for the Windows case, and it's benign otherwise. Okay, so here's the actual flow of what the ASP.NET Core module does. So it'll receive a request. The IIS will receive the request, and I'm going to say ACM just for short. ACM will recognize, I've got a request that matches that I'm supposed to deal with, and it will look in its configuration file and identify the process that it should start and the arguments that it should pass to that process. And it will start that process if it's not already running. So it does some process management for you. Now, at this point, your app is not W3WP anymore, right? This is, if you're doing a portable application with .NET Core, you're running probably .NET.exe. If you're running like a full desktop application or a standalone application, then you might be your app.exe. But it's your process. It's not W3WP. ACM will forward the request to your app process. Your app then does something with that request. That, at that point, Kestrel is receiving the request and pumping it up your request delegate, getting a response, and sends the response back to ACM. Then ACM will then give it back to IIS, and IIS will respond down to the client. This is what the configuration file looks like when you set up the ASP.NET Core module. You can see it's just adding the handler, and then the process path is specifying the process that you want to run. Arguments is the set of arguments you want passed to that process, and then you have some extra values for setting up things like logging. It'll basically capture all the standard out from the process that it starts and log it to a file. Now, this special handshake that IIS, the ASP.NET Core module does with your process looks something like this. What it will actually do is we'll set these, I believe it's these three environment variables on the process that it starts. The two are fairly obvious. It'll tell the process, when you listen for requests, I need you to listen at this path and on this port. Okay, so that tells Kestrel, I should be running at this particular server URL. The last one's kind of interesting. The last one is a pairing token. The last one's telling the process, when I send you a request, there will be a special header in that request that will have this token in it. If it doesn't have this token, it didn't come for me. Okay? And so the IIS integration code that you add to your host looks for that token and makes sure that it's there. It'll look for that token, and it'll make sure that Kestrel is running on the right address. Let's take a look at this and see how this all works. Okay, so I've got another little app here. Here's my host logic. Again, we're using Web Host Builder, setting up a host. Now I've got that use IIS integration line of code in my app to say I'm going to be running behind IIS. When you're using Visual Studio, all of our Visual Studio templates are set up to run behind IIS Express. You can see it in the run dialog. They all have a launch profile that's set up to run, have your app run behind IIS Express, which is a good analog for IIS. Okay, so to get this use IIS integration piece, you do need a special, particular package. I'll show you which one that is. Install is what I want. And if I do IIS integration, you're going to see two packages show up here. This first one is the piece that has that use IIS integration code. The second one, which is, you can't see the end of it, so it looks like .2. Move it over. It's actually .tools. I don't have enough space. There you go. Tools. That has the publish IIS tool in it. That's the thing that will help you generate the right web.config file to set up the ASP.NET Core module. Okay, so you need those packages. You need to say, I want to use IIS integration. We've already wired up the ASP.NET Core module for you in the template. There's a web.config file, and there it is. You can see it's being added as a handler. And here's its configuration. There's the process path and the arguments. Now there's some magic Visual Studio stuff going on here to some placeholders that VS will put the right launcher path and launcher args into the config file. When you publish, this will actually have either .NET.exe or your application that you've built. Okay? Now in this, what this app does is when it's run, it will, again, write out all the addresses that the app is currently listening on. And these are the addresses that Kestrel is listening on. And that's important. This isn't the address that IIS is listening on. This is the address that Kestrel is listening on. And then we're going to look for those three environment variables that I told you about, the port, the application path, and the token. And to get those environment variables, again, I'm just using the configuration API that we have in ASP.NET Core. I'm specifically using the environment variable provider so I can just quickly get those environment variables. It's just a convenient way to read a bunch of environment variables. Okay, so we should be able to see these environment variables. Let's see if that works. Run this. Okay, now first thing to note is that the browser is pointing at port 6250. You see that, 6250. That's the address that IIS Express is listening on. And you can confirm that by going down here to IIS Express, and yup, it's listening on 6250. So the browser sent a GET request to that port, and IIS received it. Then the ASP.NET Core module saw that request, and I should probably show that in web.config, the ASP.NET Core module is basically configured to deal with any request to any path and any verb. So it's just going to grab every single request. And then it's going to kick off the .NET.exe process and hand it off to Kestrel. Now, what port and address is Kestrel listening on? Well, Kestrel's listening on just the application path slash the root, and its port is 23415. And then here are the three environment variable values that are in that process that the ASP.NET Core module set up when it started that process. And you can see that they match. It's listening on the port that matches the environment variable and the path that matches the environment variable. Down here below, you can see the pairing token. So I should, when I sent this request to Kestrel, I should see a header in that request from the ASP.NET Core module that matches this pairing token. I can't see that here because I'm in the browser to IIS leg of the request. But if I can set a little breakpoint, let me stop this. Let's go into startup, and we'll set a breakpoint. Where do I do it? Let's do it at the bottom. Yeah, down the bottom. Okay, I'm gonna F5 this time. All right. Now I can't. Let's see. So let's. Can I just? Maybe I can just do an immediate window. I didn't capture what the token value was, unless someone remembers it by heart. Can I just okay? So the token value should end in 7043. That's the one that's in the environment variable. If I now go digging through the HB context, let's do it up here. So HB context request headers, a whole bunch of built-in headers that are part of the protocol. And down here, there's a couple unknown headers, and voila. There is this MS ASP.NET Core-token header that ends in 7043. And the IIS integration piece is making sure that those two things match. If a request comes in that doesn't match that, then it's like, I don't know where this request is coming from, and it'll ignore it. All right? Okay, so now I want to publish this application. When you publish an app in the .NET Core world, there's a command, .NET publish. And what that will do is during development, your app is actually running based off of restored NuGet packages. And all those NuGet packages got put somewhere in your user profile. When you publish your app, you need to collect all the binaries from those NuGet packages and put them in one folder so that your app can then be copied to wherever it is that you're going to be running it. So I need to do a publish. I can actually do that publish step from within VS. So if I just do right click and say, I have to stop the debugger. Okay, there. Yeah, right click and say publish. There it is. All right, I think I've already set up a publish profile, this IIS pub one. And what does this one do? This is going to publish to the file system, and it's going to publish my app to WAC IIS pub one. Okay? And I can see some settings. It's going to do a release publish. It's using .NET Core app. Oh, and it's got a target runtime. That means I have some changes in my project JSON file that I did not mean to have. Let me go undo those. I want this to be a portable app to start with. We'll remove these again in just a second. So this is platform, and let's get rid of this. This is because I was practicing last night and forgot to remove those. All right, so there we go. I made some change to project JSON, so it did restore. Okay, let's just do this again. I want to publish a portable version of my app. All right, so IIS pub, now let's see. File system, yes, IIS pub one, settings. That all looks good. Let me make sure there's no folder already there. Like, is there an IIS? If there's a slash, let's see. There's nothing there already. Okay, good. All right. Yes, that's what we want to do. So publish. So now this is collecting all the binaries that this app needs, putting it into a folder, putting it into that ispub1 folder. Okay, succeeded. All right, good. And now let's go look at what's there now. I should see an ispub1 folder in here now. There it is. It just popped up. All right, cool. So there's my app DLL, and there's all the stuff that it needs to run. There's the web.config file. Now, this web.config file got changed. If we look at it, it no longer has weird placeholders. It actually says, when a request comes in, ASP.NET Core Module, please run .NET. And here is the argument I want you to pass to .NET. Please run my DLL. If we were to do this from the command line, let's do that real fast. Let's go to CI. One, and if we did .NET with isintegration.dll, that should just start my app. Yeah, so that just starts my app. So does that make sense? So let's pretend the ASP.NET Core module, do that. Start my app, and then send requests to it. Okay? But you notice these placeholders got filled in. How did that happen? Well, if we look at the project.json file, you'll notice that there's this tool that got added. Remember we talked about that second package? We added that isintegration.tools package to the tools section. Project.json, and that made it available as a .NET Core tool, which is a whole other topic, but just makes it available from the command line, basically, for this project. And then down below in project.json, you'll see that there's a post-publish script. And this says, whenever you're done publishing this app, please now run .NET publish IIS, run the tool that I had configured up above. And that will make sure that the web.config file has the right values. That's why the web.config file looks different than it did inside of VS, okay? All right, so now to set this up with IIS, I think we need like INET manager or something. Let's create I've got a site already here. Let's create an app. We're gonna add an application. Let's call this ispub1. I'm gonna change the app pool. I don't need any .NET framework stuff in this app pool, so I can say no managed code here, because all the managed code is actually going to be run by .NET.exe in my separate process. So in this, I don't need anything, any managed code in this app pool. So I say no managed code. And then the physical path should be C:ispub, right? Where is it? There it is. OK. Good. I think I did that right. Let's see. So I should be able to browse to the app now. And voila, yeah, you can see that the path is now ispub1, so it's actually running in IIS. So that's how you can publish an app. Now, the other variant of this that I wanted to show is that was what we call a portable application, right? It was just a DLL. I could take the contents of that ispub1 folder, and I could copy it to a Linux or Mac machine, and as long as that machine has .NET Core installed, I could run .NET.exe space, the name of that binary, and it would work. If you were here in the previous talk, Glenn Condren and Steve Lasker were showing doing this left and right inside of Docker, inside of Linux containers, and it works beautifully. The other way you could do this is you could actually take your app and build it as a standalone application. That means you want to actually have a native .exe just for your app. Now, if you do that, that native .exe is now platform specific. You'll build a native .exe just for Windows or just for Linux or whatever. But you can do that, and when you do it, your app is fully standalone. Like it'll literally have its own copy of a CLR in the base class library. So let's take a look at what that looks like. We'll leave this guy open. So now I'm going to go back and can I just like undo my changes? So first of all, we need to tell the .NET Core what kind of native .exe do we want. I'm going to say I want a Win10 x64 .exe. And up here for this .NET Core app package, this is sort of the core set of libraries that every .NET Core app really needs to run. I'm going to remove this type platform modifier. Type platform means assume that .NET Core is already there. If I remove it, it's going to say, you need to restore this now so that the app can bring .NET Core with it. Okay, so I'm going to save that. I think that's all I need to do. Good. Now let's publish this app. And I'm going to have a profile, I think, for this one, ispub2. This is going to be publishing to the file system again, publishing to a different location, ispub2. But you'll notice now it knows that there's a target runtime. Like, this is going to be building a Win10 64-bit specific binary. All right, let's publish. OK. Should be wrapping up. Good, succeeded. All right, and let me go back to let's go to ispub2 now. Now, you know, look in here and you'll see that now I have a .exe for my app. And I should be able to just like double click this thing. And it should just run. Yeah, so now I have an executable. And this is a native executable for Windows. It only runs on Windows, but it's a native executable that you now get. And you'll notice that I have things here like corecLR.dll and a whole lot of other stuff, like all the system.everything is now included with my app. And the cool thing about this is this app is completely standalone. I should be able to, I could copy this to a thumb drive and grab someone's random Win10 machine and put it on there, and we could run that executable as long as you're on a Win10 64-bit machine, and it will work. And nothing on that machine should be able to impact that app, so it's completely standalone. That's pretty awesome. You don't need to have .NET Core installed on the machine. The downside is that, you know, it's a little bigger. Like, this is like a 50 megabyte, like, you know, standalone application, so that's a little large. If we go look at the other one was, I think, like a order of magnitude smaller. This is only like 4 megabytes. So you are bringing everything with you, which means you're going to pay for that in size, but it's kind of nice that it's very self-contained. All right, so now if we go back to the IIS, oh, and I meant to show the web.config file. ispub2. The web.config file looks a little bit different. Instead of saying run .NET.exe, it's now saying just run my executable, and it doesn't need any arguments. If you're doing the portable version where you're running .NET.exe, you need to make sure that .NET.exe is available on the system path, because IIS is going to need to be able to find it. The ASP.NET Core module is going to need to be able to find it. In this case, it's just going to run your executable, all right? And I could go into IIS and set that up the same way as before, and it works exactly the same way. But that's how you can deal with a fully standalone application with .NET Core and ASP.NET Core. All right, cool. Let's go back. All right, I'm going to talk about request handling now. So when a request comes into the server and actually gets handed up to your app, what happens? How does that work? Well, you define what you want to happen for each request in startup, and you use middleware to do that. You use middleware. Middleware is a component that does something with the request, but it also, and it does it asynchronously, but it also has a next pointer. It knows about the next middleware in the pipeline, and it has the option of calling the next guy or not. So you might do some stuff, call next, then you could do some more stuff after the other guy is done. You could choose not to call the other guy at all. You could throw an exception. All those things are possible from within middleware. So you use middleware to define what you want to happen for each request. And then when the host gets built, there's an application builder that will take all the middleware that you've set up and turn that into a request delegate. Now, we have lots of middleware that's built into the box. We have routing middleware, authentication, static files. You guys can read the rest of the list. You can write your own middleware, and that's what we're going to take a look at next. This is the request delegate abstraction. It's what we talked about before. It's something that takes an HTTP request, you know, HTTP context, and does something asynchronous with it. It's literally that simple. Middleware is a little bit more mind-bending to understand. This is the core abstraction for middleware in ASP.NET Core. So the request delegate that your middleware func takes, that request delegate is the next pointer. You should think of that as pointing to the next guy. And then your middleware returns a request delegate. So it takes the next pointer, and then it provides a request delegate that represents what that middleware does. And inside the request delegate that it returns, it might choose to call next, it might do something before, it might do something after. So that's the core abstraction of middleware. You don't usually write middleware as an inline func like this. You usually write it as a class using a very convenient convention, which looks like this. This is how you would normally write middleware. You have a constructor that takes the next pointer. It takes a request delegate, which is the next guy in the pipeline. And then you define your request delegate, like what you want to do. That's that invoke method. Notice it takes an HTTP context and does something asynchronously with it. That's your request delegate. So in there is where you have the option of calling next or not, doing something before or doing something after. And you'll notice all the dot, dot, dots. You can use dependency injection in your middleware implementation to take services from your app or services from the host. To use middleware that's written this way, there's a nice extension method that's app.useMiddleware(t), where the T is the type of your middleware. It's also considered polite, you know, a kindness, to provide an additional extension method that's nicely named that just calls useMiddleware(t) for the user. you know, like for static file middleware, we provide use static files. It's a nice thing to do. So if you're writing middleware, provide that extra extension method. But now you can take this class and your extension method, package it up in a NuGet package, share it with the world. Fortune and glory. All right, so this is what the middleware pipeline looks like. So a request comes in, and it's a pipeline, right? So you have the first middleware. It gets to do some stuff. It has a next pointer. It chooses to call next. That's great. Next middleware gets a chance to run. It does some stuff with the request. It has a next pointer. Chooses to call it. Great. The third middleware gets to do some stuff, and it decides, you know what? There's no more middleware, or we're done. And so then it returns. And then on the return path, everyone gets another chance to do more stuff on the outbound path. Like you could look at what's coming down in the response and modify it and do things to it. And then finally, the response goes out. Now, this diagram makes it look like middleware is a purely linear pipeline. That's not actually, strictly speaking, true. Middleware can actually branch. Like you might decide that based on something in the request, I'm going to execute this whole bunch of middleware. And based on if that stuff's not in the request, then I'm going to do this other middleware. So you can actually fork the middleware pipeline. There's a helper method called map, where you can like map a bunch of middleware to like a request that matches a particular prefix. Like it has API as the first path segment. If you have API requests, then maybe you go down one middleware pipeline. If you don't, then go do something else. So that's possible as well. So this is a somewhat simplified view. All right, let's take a look at request handling. All right, so first thing we're going to do is a test. Do we understand middleware? Okay, so we are going to do, we're just going to do file new project. We'll start from scratch. This is the middleware test. Okay, let's see. All right, it's as much a test for me as it is for anyone else. All right, so we've got just a simple little app. Doesn't have anything in it. And we're going to try and write middleware using the core abstraction. Now, you almost never do this, but if you can do it, it shows that you understand the underlying abstraction of middleware. You've got the zen of middleware. So we want to use some middleware here. Oh, by the way, this run method is middleware. It's just a middleware that doesn't care at all about next, right? It just gives you a request delegate and says, here's my request delegate. I don't care what next is. I'm not calling it. Here's what I want you to do. Notice it's a request delegate. It takes a context, does something async with it. It's sort of sugar on a middleware that does nothing with next. But we're going to do one that actually does something with next. So we're going to use middleware. So it's a func of request delegate that returns a request delegate. So the first request delegate is the next pointer. That's the next middleware in the pipeline. So let's call that guy next. All right. And then we need to write a func that returns a request delegate. Okay, what's a request delegate? That's something that takes a context and does something async with it. So let's do something async here. What are we going to do? Let's add a header. So let's say context.response.headers ignite header. And let's say woot. This is going to be the value. Okay? All right, and then we need to call next. Like if we want the next guy to get a chance to run, if we want like our run method to be able to run, we need to call next. So I'm going to call next. And what does that take? That's going to take, next is a request delegate too, so I need to give it the context. And this is async, so I need to return a task. So let's just return the task from calling next. I think that's it. Did that work? Is all the squigglies gone away? All the squigglies have gone away. Okay, that's a good sign. So let's run this. Now, I expect to see hello world. Okay, so that means we made it to our run method. So the next call actually worked. Did our middleware actually do anything? I'm going to go into the F12 debugging tools in Edge, and let's refresh so we can see. Okay, there's a request. Do I see the response header? There it is. Ignite header woot. We did it. Wow. Wow, that's two lambdas. It's a lambda within a lambda. It's like inception. It's a dream within a dream. Yes. So you can do this. This is fun, right? Normally, you don't write middleware this way, right? Normally, you will create a class. Let's look at how you normally, at least now we know how it works, though. So let's go look at some middleware implementations that actually use the class pattern. I've got some. This is a sample app, actually, you can find in the Entropy repo in our org. This one has two custom middleware in it. It has a middleware for doing XHTTP header overrides. What that is like if you know the browser sent a GET request, but based off of either a header or something in the query string, you want to tell the server, please treat this like some other HTTP verb. Treat it like a post, or treat it like a put, or treat it like a delete, okay? By setting something in a header or in a query string parameter. Then we have this other middleware, which is, this guy was not polite. Like, they did not provide the nice extension method, but we can still use middleware FT. This one is just a middleware that returns a greeting. Now, notice you can pass additional parameters to the middleware when you add it to your pipeline, and we'll see how you can consume those. Okay, let's look at this second one first. We'll look at the second one first. So this is a class. It has to have a constructor that takes next, and it does. So there's next. And then, like, remember the dot, 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 you can take additional parameters. Now, some of those parameters could be parameters that came when the middleware was added to the pipeline. Like, this greeting is going to be that yo parameter that we saw up above. You remember that? Yo, okay? And then you have the option also of taking additional services that are available that were configured in the application or configured by the host, like this iService provider, sort of a low-level host service for getting services. And so this middleware captures all those. It doesn't actually use them, though. It's just showing that you can. Then here is the request delegate that this middleware defines. It takes an HTTP context, does something async with it. What is it going to do? Well, first, it's going to display a greeting based off of the parameter that we passed in. So this should say, yo, middleware. And then lastly, it tells you what it thinks the HTTP method is. Like, is it a get? Is it a post? Is it a put? Okay? Now, before this middleware runs, the XHTTP header override middleware is going to get a chance to run. So it does the same pattern. It's going to has a constructor that takes the next pointer. It captures it, and this guy is going to use it. It is going to call next. And then in its request delegate implementation, in its invoke method, it looks for this particular query string or header, and then if it's present, it will change the method on the request. And then it calls next. Okay? All right, so let's see how this runs. Now, important thing here is that middleware is ordered, right? Like, this guy is going to run first and get a chance to change the HTTP verb, and then this guy is going to display it. If these were reversed, then the second middleware wouldn't see the first, you get what I mean. They're ordered. Okay, so that worked. So, yo, middleware, this request was a get. So this was just a browser request. Of course, it was a get. We didn't provide the header or the query string for XHTTP header override. Method override. So let's do that. What's everyone's favorite HTTP verb? Do you like patch? Patch is cool, right? Like patch or options. So there. Now the second middleware thinks that the method was a patch because the first middleware got a chance to change it. Does that make sense? So that's how you write custom middleware. You write a class. Where'd it go? You write a class that has a constructor that takes next, and then you write an invoke method that implements your middleware's request delegate. Okay. Cool. Let's switch back. So that's request handling. Learned all about middleware. All right, let's talk about a specific middleware. We're going to talk about routing. So routing is a middleware that ASP.NET Core provides for you, and it is actually the foundation for how MVC works in ASP.NET Core, which is pretty cool. We're going to try and understand how that all happens. Now, the routing middleware itself is, like, amazingly simple. Like, you can go look at the code. It's, like, 50 lines of code. It does almost nothing. I'll tell you what it does. The routing middleware, you give it an iRouter, which is some interface, and all the routing middleware does with an iRouter is it, like, invokes it and gives it a context object. And if that iRouter, if that route matches, then it will set a request delegate on the context. If it doesn't match, it doesn't set a request delegate. And then the middleware, if it sees a request delegate, it'll invoke it. Otherwise, it just calls the next guy, calls the next middleware. That's all it does. So the point of routing, right, is that you want to, like, based on something in the request, you want to, like, invoke different logic. Like, if it's the request matches this template path, URI template, then do this. If it matches this URI template, then do that. So, like, where is all that fancy logic? Like, it's obviously not in the middleware itself. The middleware itself is incredibly simple. So all the interesting stuff that the routing middleware does is actually in iRouter implementations. So let's talk about a couple of them. One is the route collection. Route collection is an iRouter. And all it is a bunch of, it has a collection of iRouters. And when you execute the route collection, it just goes through the iRouters one by one, and sees if one of them matches. If one of them matches, then whatever request delegate that guy returned, the route collection returns. And that's it. Route collection just iterates through a bunch of iRouters and executes them and matches on the first one. Okay? Route is also an iRouter, like a route with a capital R. And this is the fancy guy that you kind of, the thing that you would kind of expect to see in the routing middleware. The route class is what implements all of the support for route templates. You know that thing you do with MVC where you say like curly brace controller, curly brace, and curly brace action, curly brace. You know, you put these placeholders in a template, a pattern, and you say like if this pattern matches, then I want to extract these values out of the URI path and then make that available to me. And then MVC does fancy stuff to pick which action to invoke. That's what the route class does. It implements that route template notion. But it does something else that's interesting. It takes an iRouter, which is kind of like the a link pointer. It's kind of like a linked list type notion. If the route iRouter matches, all it does is it calls that next iRouter. It just calls the next guy. So you could like chain them together. You could say, if this template matches, then call this iRouter. If that iRouter matches, then call that iRouter, and so forth. That's all it does. It just calls the next guy, and that'll be important. And then lastly, there's this notion of a route builder. What route builder does is route builder, you give it a default handler, a route handler. And you then add routes to the route builder. You just say like map route, map route, map route. Everyone's familiar probably with the map route method in MVC. Map route just takes a template. You don't specify like a request delegate or anything like that. You just give it a template and say, please add this route. Well, the route builder, when you call map route on it, it will create a route for that template. But then it will set the next guy that it should be called, like the link, the target of that route, to be the default handler that you set up on the route builder. You sort of see that? And so what MVC does is it just sets itself as the default handler on a route builder. It then gives you the route builder and says, add whatever routes you want. All those routes get added, and MVC is the route handler that all those routes are now pointing to. And so then that route builder is then used to create a route collection that gets handed to the route middleware. And when the route middleware runs, the route collection iterates through all those routes that you added. If one of them matches, it then executes the MVC route handler. And that's the one that does all the fancy stuff of like looking for a controller, looking for an action. And by the way, this whole system supports link generation too. We're not going to go into that because this is already plenty to get wrap our heads around. Let's take a look at routing real quick. I need to put 5. Routing demo. Okay. So I've added routing, the routing package. You have to add a routing package, right? So manage new. Okay, never mind. We won't go look at that. there's the routing package, Microsoft ASP.NET Core Routing. That's the package you need if you want to use the routing middleware. All right, and then if we look in here, let's see. Let's not look at the complicated one first. Let's look at the simple one. So here, I'm using the routing middleware, use router. And remember, all the routing middleware does is you give it an iRouter and it executes it. So I need to give it an iRouter. To create an iRouter, I'm going to use Route Builder. And for initially, all I'm going to do is just a simple pattern where I say, instead of saying map route, I'm just going to say map get or map put. I'm just going to map a route template, and I'm going to explicitly provide the request delegate that I want it to execute if that route hits. So this should look pretty simple, like right? If I go to slash time, then show me the time. If I go to slash random, then show me some random number between 1 and 100. If I go to slash hello curly brace name, then get the route data and display hello, whatever that name is. This is kind of, you know those node demos that everyone does where they like write 5 lines of code and they say like, you know, if I get a get request to this path and do this function, that's exactly what this is. I'm saying map this path to this function. It's exactly the same code. So let's take a look at this. Let's run it. So if we go to time, we get the time. If we go to random, then we get some random number, and I should be able to just like keep refreshing this and get a bunch of random numbers. And then the cool one is if we go to hello, like ignite, then that's actually pulling a value out of the URI and then putting it into the response. So hello ignite. Notice the way it was doing that. Did you notice that? It's like calling get route data on the context. That's because one of the things the routing middleware does is if it matches a route, it puts the route data as a request feature on the context. Remember request features from way back? There's an iRouteData request feature that if a route hits, it adds to the context. And that gives you access to that route data throughout the routing pipeline. So that's kind of cool. So that's sort of the simple case of routing. The more MVC-like case is like this one below. So here, I've got the route builder again, and I'm just saying use router of routes. I'm adding another routing middleware. But this time, I'm telling the route builder, here is your default handler. If any of the routes that I add with map route hit, then I want you to call this default handler. And the default handler that I've created is, what is it going to do? It's going to get the route data, and then it's just going to print out the controller action and ID if those route values are available. Does that make sense? So if there was a route that hit, and it extracted a controller value from the URI, an action value from the URI, or an ID value from the URI, then display those. Like, that's pretty much what MVC does, right? Like, it then takes those values and goes and finds a controller for that value and executes it. Okay, so let's see if that works. So if I go back here, and I say home index, and then, I don't know, some random ID. So we got home index ID. And so it's calling into my route handler to display those values. So to get MVC then, all you need then is to replace this default handler with the MVC really fancy default handler implementation, right? And that's exactly what it does. If we go, let me see if I can find it. So if we go to GitHub, I mean, we have to look at the code. Like let's just see it. Let's just see it. So what it is, it's like, it's a application builder extension, I think. Application builder extensions. Yeah, this guy. All right, so let's make it a little bigger so you can see it. So down here someplace, there should be use MVC. Okay, there's use MVC, right? Now, MVC is doing a bunch of stuff here to verify that the services it needs are actually configured. But down at the bottom, there's a route builder, right? And it's then specifying the default handler to be some special MVC route handler. It then hands off the route builder to you to let you call map route. Okay, so now it's got a bunch of routes. It does one extra thing, which we're not going to go into great detail. It adds an additional route to the route table, which handles attribute routing. There's like a special route that uses this special tree structure in order to deal with all your attribute routes. So attribute routing is enabled by default in MVC, and then calls routes.build to get the route collection and hands it to useRouter. That's all MVC is doing when you say use MVC. Just built right on top of routing. Now you know. It's pretty cool. Okay. So let's talk now about MVC a little bit. We're not going to deal with the basics of MVC. We're going to go talk about some of the more powerful extensibility features in MVC. I mean, this is a deep dive, right? There's two cool features in MVC that are lesser known that you might find useful. One of them is called application parts. Now, the application part manager in MVC is the piece of MVC that finds stuff. Like, it finds the controllers. It finds the view components, tag helpers, any metadata references, compilation references for Razor. It's the thing that goes and finds stuff. And one of the principles we have with MVC is we want you to be able to configure MVC without having to like replace its guts whenever you want to change something. So for example, let's say you want to find controllers in MVC that are in a random assembly that you're going to load at runtime. How do you do that? In MVC 5, there's a controller factory abstraction in MVC 5, but if you wanted to customize it, you were kind of like ripping out the one that was there and replacing it with a whole bunch of your code. And we had this never-ending series of bugs where people would be like, could you make this one method virtual? Because I just want to tweak this one thing, and I just want to reuse some of your logic. In ASP.NET Core, we've tried really hard to make MVC configurable so you can use what's there without having to rip its guts out. An application part manager is a good example of that. If you want to get some controllers from some other spot, this is the guy you want to use. An application part is a resource that the application part manager should look at to find stuff. Normally, it's an assembly, but it doesn't have to be. It could be something else. So you can add application parts. And then there are feature providers that will look at all the application parts in your app and find useful features. Like, and features in this context means controllers, view components, tag helpers. So the feature providers will look at all the application parts and say, is there any controllers here? Yep, okay. Are there any view components there? Yep, okay, you're good. And you have the opportunity to customize either. You can add additional application parts, or you can add additional feature providers. You might create a new feature provider if you want to change what it means to get a controller. Like, I want to have a controller that's like an open generic. You could implement a feature provider that does that. Now, the second part of this is the application model. After everything has been found, after we've decided what all the controllers are, all the tag helpers and stuff are in the system, MVC builds an in-memory representation of the app and says, OK, I've got all these controllers. Here are all the actions. Here it is. Do whatever you want with it. And you can read it. You can look at it, inspect it. You might use that to generate a metadata representation of your application. That's how, actually, the Swashbuckle package implements support for Swagger for APIs in ASP.NET Core. It just looks at this application model. You can also modify it. You can implement custom conventions that change what the name of a controller is, or what attribute routes a particular action has on it, or what parameters it has. You can fiddle with it however you want and implement new conventions. Like, if you want, for example, let's say you really liked the convention in ASP.NET Web API, where if a method began with something that looked like an HTTP verb, then you wanted it to be that action to be just for that verb. That doesn't happen by default in ASP.NET Core. But if you like that model, you can easily implement it with an application model convention. You just write a convention that looks at all the actions. Do they begin with get, post, put, or delete? OK, then I'm going to add like an HTTP get attribute to this guy, or an HTTP post attribute to this guy. And boom, you're done. In fact, this is exactly what we did. We implemented a package that we call the Web API Compat Shim that re-implements all of the conventions from ASP.NET Web API for people who are porting from Web API to ASP.NET Core. And it was done using these application model conventions. So it's a really powerful feature, super duper useful. Let me show you an example. All right, wait a minute. Let's look at this generic controller sample first. So this is a sample that's going to show you about application parts, and specifically about writing a custom feature provider. So the idea in this sample is, I've got some model types. See, I've got a sprocket, and I've got a widget. And then you'll see there's this generic controller of T. Now, generic controller of T, that's not a controller by default, right? Like, we don't support open generic controllers. Like, how would we instantiate a generic controller of T? But let's say what you want is, like, I have a bunch of model types, and I just want the same controller implementation to be used for each one. I don't want to create a sprocket controller and a widget controller and a foo controller and a bar controller. I'm just going to have a generic controller, and it's just going to magically wrap itself around any of the model types that are in my system. That would be kind of interesting. Also, though, if I do decide that I want to have a specific controller for a specific model, like I want to have a sprocket controller, then I can do that, and that overrides. So the generic controller would be like a fallback. Okay, that's the idea of this app. So you see, we've got a few controllers here. We have a home controller that is just going to dump out what it thinks are all of the actions in the system. Okay, it's just going to say, these are all the actions that we think are available. We've got a sprocket controller that just says, hello from sprocket controller. And then we've got our generic controller of T, which says, hello from generic controller. And then we've got this generic controller feature provider. What does this guy do? So this is an iApplication feature provider. This is extending the application part model. And what it does is it knows about a set of entity types. You see, it's just a static class. Like, it's hard-coded in this app. But you can imagine it reading it from a database or whatever. And it says, like, for all the model types that are in the system, let's first check to see if there's already a controller for that model type. So it constructs a name of a controller and says, is there any controller that has, is there already a sprocket controller? Is there already a widget controller? If there's not, then it's going to create a concrete type out of generic controller of T. And it's just going to add that controller. So this feature provider adds generic controller of T for each model type to the set of available controllers. It extends the set of controllers that have been discovered. To wire this guy up, I believe that's done in startup. So you go into the application part manager. and you can add additional feature providers. So here it's adding that generic controller feature provider. By the way, I mentioned that scenario previously where you can like add completely additional application parts. Like if you want to add an assembly and say, find some controllers here using the normal logic, this is how you would do that. You could just say add application part, and you see you just pass in assembly. You could add dynamically loaded assemblies here. That's pretty cool. Now, there's one other part to this, is that if that controller, because it's a generic controller, its name by default is going to be some hideous looking thing. It'll be like generic controller backtick one bracket widget, right? Because the name of a controller usually is derived from its type. And the name of a controller is pretty important, because that's what you use in like routing. Like if I wanted to route to this controller, I'd have to type that into my routes. And that would be horrible. So instead, I'm going to use the application model conventions to change the name of this controller. So this is a application model convention for a controller in this case, just for a single controller. And all it's going to do is it's going to go into the set of controllers. You get an in-memory representation of all the controllers that have been discovered. And it's going to ask, is this particular controller a generic controller? If so, let's change its name to just be the entity type. All right? Now if we run this app, oh my goodness, 4 minutes. If we run this app, there it goes. Okay, so first it's going to browse to the home controller, which just dumps out all the actions that it knows in the system. And you can see that it knows about home index, it knows about sprocket index. Those are normal controllers. And it also knows about generic controller of T for which one? It should be widget. Because widget doesn't have a controller, so it did a fallback to generic controller of T. And we can we should be able to call that guy. What was it? I think I just do sprocket. Is that like so? Sprocket would be hello from a non-generic sprocket controller. That was just a normal controller call. And if I now go to widget, there's that. That's the generic controller of T being called. So you can customize what it means to be a controller. Customize how they get found. And I think that we'll stop on that one. All right. Now, I've got 3 minutes left. And I really want to show you some new features that are coming in 1.1. That was application model. That was application parts. Really great stuff in MVC. There's lots of other new stuff there as well. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's coming in ASP.NET Core 1.1. We have additional middleware that's coming, URL rewriting, response caching. I hear we're also looking at adding compression middleware as well. So it's not on this list yet, but it's being looked at. We had a really great pull request from the community. We have WebListener, which is our new server we talked about. That's the HBCIS-based server. We have a model where you can put middleware inside your MVC filters. So like if you want to just like compress one action using the new compression middleware, you could do that. So that's pretty cool. Precompiled views is coming. And then view components as tag helpers is a really nice way to be able to call a view component. I'd like to show you that one. So let me do one last demo before we end. Now, if you don't know what view components are, view component is like you want to have a little piece of a view that gets rendered on a page, but it's not just a partial. It's not just a partial HTML. It's actually got some logic in front of it. Let me see if I can. Where's my view component tag helper? There it is. So, for example, I was thinking that my Uber boss Scott Guthrie, that he's a great guy. He's done fantastic stuff for the company. He really should have his own tag helper. Like he needs to have his own tag helper. I think that's important. So I wrote a view component for Scott Guthrie. And so a view component is just something that has an invoke method, lets you run some logic, and then render a view. And then you can call that within your view someplace and have like a little piece of your view that's rendered by this view component. So that's what a view component is. And I've got that one wired up. Now, the syntax for executing a view component looks like this. You do component.invoke, the name of the view component you want to invoke, and then you pass any parameters that you need as an anonymous object, okay? And that works. That works. Like if we run this, we have our Scott Guthrie view component. Let's see if we can get it up and running. Is it? There it comes. Da-da. All right, yeah. Okay, so we got Scott Guthrie in ASCII art. And he's got the correct shirt color. And I've always wondered, I've always wondered, what would he look like if he actually wore a different color shirt? But fortunately, we can find out. Like, we can say, like, well, what if he was had a green shirt? We can refresh it. Oh, okay. It actually looks pretty good. Like, maybe we should branch out. But so this is pretty nice. But what if, like, it's a little clunky to have to call a view component using an anonymous object for the parameters. What if instead, let's comment this out, and let's say you could just say, I have a Scott tag for my view component, and I can specify his shirt color, and let's look, see what he looks like in blue, okay? So this, you notice it's turning up purple. It's because the tooling is recognizing this as a tag helper, and it's giving me help, actually, over the attributes and such. So if I run this now, I should see there's Scott in blue. So this is, what we're doing is we're taking all your view components, and we're actually generating a tag helper for them. So now when you pass parameters to your view component, you can just do that as attributes on a tag, and you can even add custom stuff. Like if you want to like customize now the output of your view component, you could just say, you know, some random attribute here, and you get HTML IntelliSense over the additional attributes. So that's view components as tag helpers, something that's coming in 1.1. All right, that was my last demo. Thank you for sticking it out and listening to everything. That was the futures, we hit that. And I encourage you all to join us, try out the new bits. If you haven't installed them, go download the .NET Core SDK. A lot of these samples are available for you online to try out and play with. And thank you all for being here. I will stick around and answer questions.